An Instagram post gets an unexpected boost. A TikTok catches in the algorithm. Sometimes that's all it takes to launch someone into internet fame. But then what? This Blew Up is a new podcast documentary that reveals how social media stardom is made. It's a different kind of fame that's not always as glamorous as it looks. From Spotify and the Ringer Podcast Network, I'm Alyssa Bereznek. You can listen to This Blew Up on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tara Palmieri. I'm Puck Senior Political Correspondent, and this is Somebody's Gotta Win. On this show, I speak with Nathan Daschle. He's a Democratic strategist who is the executive director of the Democratic Governors Association. He comes to the show armed with numbers and analysis to make the case that Democrats might do better than we expect in the Senate, House, and even the presidential. He explains the death of split-ticket voting, how the abortion measures in battleground states could impact the races, and how he thinks the Biden team could tune up their messaging. Okay, Nathan, I just bumped into you at the DC cafeteria, La Tosca, and I was sitting down with a Republican who said to me, totally happy to have RFK hanging around. He's here to stay. Obviously, it helps Trump out. What are the Democrats going to do about RFK?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, there is nothing that takes the sheen off of someone like a presidential campaign. And RFK has not really been a relevant player with respect to the two-party candidates for long enough. As soon as somebody figures out that he takes more of a vote from them, they're going to go after him hard. And I don't think that he's going to be able to carry the same luster through November.
But he's at double digits.
Yeah, he's at double digits. But for a lot of reasons, I think a lot of those Dem voters will come home. And I think RFK, when you look at him as a, if you look at him like a product, like as a political product, he's so much more similar to Trump than to Biden.
Because he has so many different positions that change all the time.
Yeah. And frankly, he's kind of got that unhinged quality that both of them share. That's like a little bit out there. And I think people who are really skeptical of the government naturally are drawn to both of them. But I think at the end of the day, RFK is going to, after I think the Biden campaign really figures him out, I think RFK Jr. will take more from Trump. And I just don't buy that Trump people are not worried about him. I think both sides are worried about him now because he's unpredictable. And it's an X factor that nobody really understands how it's going to play out. But I don't buy that the Trump people are happy he's in the race.
It's just a matter of like who can define him first. Is that what you think?
It's a matter of who can define him first, but it's also a matter of what is there to define. Like, to the extent that he exists and hence he's definable, I think he's so much more appealing to a Trump candidate than, or to a Trump voter than to a Biden voter. He's got the Kennedy last name.
That name ID, though, could confuse people who are low information voters.
Yeah, the Kennedy last name is an asset for sure. And it's almost like he's taking advantage of that. But that can't be right.
Oh, no way. He wouldn't possibly do that.
But RFK's team has said that their goal is to defeat Joe Biden.
There was a woman on the team that said that.
Did the campaign disabuse the rest of us of that notion?
They kept saying that Trump wanted to make him his running mate. They did push that. And Trump sort of tried to distance himself from that, which was interesting. Even though he did muse the idea of having a Kennedy on his ticket, I think that's more of a Cary Grant thing. It kind of pumps up his ego. It's all central casting. Okay. But I don't know. I mean, he was an environmentalist for so long, and that's what he's known for.
Yeah. And actually, strangely, one of my first jobs out of college was working for the NRDC, where he was a major figure.
What is it, NRDC?
The Natural Resources Defense Council. It's an environmental group. And he was one of the founding figures of that organization. And so that's how I first knew him. But then he got into this anti-vax thing and a lot of conspiracy theories. And if you're a conspiracy theorist, you're probably not voting for Joe Biden. If you're a conspiracy theorist, you're probably going to lean toward Trump. And I think that's, it's that sort of brand and appeal that RFK brings to the table. And I think there are some people now who are on the Dem side who are drawn to his last name. But I just think that, you know, hundreds of million dollars of advertising really tends to define things. And I don't think he'll be able to kind of straddle that line like he has so far. I think it'd be much easier for Biden to define him as somebody of the Trump ilk than vice versa.
He's not really on any of the battleground states, I don't think. Maybe one or two.
Yeah.
But he has the money. He's got a running mate with lots of cash, Nicole Shanahan.
Yep.
I think there's a feeling that he's here to stay and that he will have some impact on the race regardless.
Yeah, I think he'll have an impact on the race. I mean, in a race as close as this, I mean, I think that's why both sides are nervous about him, is because he's an X factor and he's unpredictable. And I think if I were running Biden's campaign, I would prefer him not to be in the race because I'd rather just go straight up head to head against Trump. But if he has to be in the race, I wouldn't lose too much sleep because I think at the end of the day, he draws from Trump voters more than he draws from Biden voters.
It does give like the double haters, though, another option, right? And those double haters, the feeling is that a double hater would more likely go to Biden than to Trump, or the hope is that, and maybe it's giving them a third option.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although the double haters, I'm a little skeptical that we can lump them all in together because I sort of feel like there are five groups of voters. Mm-hmm. You've got the true believers for Trump, the true believers for Biden.
Are there true believers for Biden? I feel like he doesn't have...
No, there's no doubt. I mean, Joe Biden does not...
What do they look like? Who are true believers for Biden?
I think they look like the whole country. I mean, there are people from all across all demographics who I think are truly inspired by Biden. But there are, I think the second group of people are the unmotivated partisans, people who think it's their duty to vote Republican or duty to vote Democrat, but don't really love the candidate. And then the fifth category are the undecideds, who I think are kind of the same as the double haters. But it's the unmotivated partisans where I think is that's where the real action is. Mm-hmm. Because Biden won a number of the Republicans in 2020. If Biden holds the Dems together, I think that he'll win. So I think there's a lot of action there at these kind of unmotivated partisans, the people who think it's their duty to vote Dem but aren't in love with their candidates. And those are the people right now who I think some of them are flirting with RFK Jr. Some of them are voting uncommitted in Michigan.
Well, they seem motivated, but they're motivated to protest vote. That's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, and they're motivated to protest vote when it's in theory. The character of a presidential campaign in November never feels like the character of a presidential campaign in April. You know, it will just change and evolve.
Yeah, it's getting tighter. That's for sure. Biden is making up in the polls. It's like point or two off. They've been spending a ton of money, the Biden campaign, on advertising. Trump has not spent anything.
He'll have all the money he needs.
Yeah, he'll have it. I think they raised like $60 million, but now he's at $90 million, which isn't bad. I think Biden's still at like $172 million. I could be wrong with the numbers, but it's still a 3-to-1 kind of ratio, or at least close to that. Again, everyone's saying he has free advertising every time he steps outside of that courtroom. And you know, you've got wall-to-wall coverage in all the networks, and he's saying, I'm being politically persecuted. But I guess depends on what the audience is. Is the audience independent voters that are kind of tired of that trade, or they feel sympathetic for him? I don't know. But this is something that's sort of sprouted out of the whole RFK phenomenon, that he takes more young people and African-Americans from Biden than he does from Trump. And it creates this impression that there are more young people that are Trump curious. Like, can you explain that to me or deconstruct it to me? I've seen it in a few different polls, and I'm wondering if it's just the polling or if it's like a real phenomenon.
So if you go back to what I believe in these five groups of voters, the true believers, there are more true believers for Trump than there are for Biden.
Yeah.
And the people who are motivated for Trump, they'll walk through fire for him. And, you know, Biden has a lot of strengths. Arousing that sort of passion is not one of them.
That's why I asked. I was like, are there really true believers? Because it doesn't feel like there's a movement for Biden.
Yeah, well, you know, he's
a safety net.
And this race, as we'll kind of get into, like, what are the dynamics of this race? This race, I think, unlike other presidentials, like, presidential reelects are in general, I think, primarily referenda on the incumbent.
Exactly. But they want to make this one a choice.
They do. The Biden people do want to make it a choice. But I think it also organically is becoming one of a choice because Trump is unlike your typical challenger. Like the typical presidential reelect, you have a well-defined incumbent running against a less well-defined challenger. So it stands to reason that the incumbent will give more of a flavor to the race, and the race will be more about whether you like or don't like the incumbent. But in this instance, Trump is probably better defined than Biden. And Trump has been on the national ballot three times.
I mean, what more can you say about the guy that you haven't already heard?
Right, which is why I think, you know, for advertising, what is the advertising going to do for Trump?
I don't know. That's why I was wondering, are the advertising dollars actually changing the game for Biden right now? Or is this just like the natural evolution of the election, like you said?
I think for Biden, there's upside. I think there is.
Okay.
Because you got this chunk of the, what I call the unmotivated partisans, the Dems who want to vote Dem, but kind of be needing to be given a reason, Biden needs to shore them up. But I think advertisements talking about both what he's done, but I think more importantly, what he's going to do over the next 4 years, because campaigns are always about the future, not the past. And I think a message that he gives, talking about what he's going to do, I think can bring those Dems back into the fold, as well as some of those double haters. So I think there's a much greater opportunity for President Biden to educate and persuade voters than Trump.
Okay. To be honest, like I am a political journalist and I'm not even quite clear what he is promising for the next term. Prosperity?
I think there are three things. I would like to see a different element into the messaging, but I might be in the minority in that one. But I think there are three things that the president wants people to know about the future and what a second term would be about. And the first is the economy. I mean, there's a disconnect right now between how people feel about the economy and how the economy is actually performing. And by virtually any metric, the economy is performing well. And I think President Biden can make the case that he has his finger on the pulse. He understands the extent the president can, what he needs to do to continue to make our economy healthy. And that means jobs. It's economy, not like in the sense that, it's going to make your investments get a higher return, but in the sense that it's going to mean jobs.
Okay.
And it's going to be about domestic industry. I think it's an economic message that appeals to union workers more than Wall Street. So then you got that. The second thing is, and I know we'll get into this, is choice. That is just a major issue.
It's going to be like the number one issue probably, right?
It's going to be the number one issue. And it is a major dividing line between Biden and Trump, and really between Democrats and Republicans. And we can get into that more, but you can't really talk about the presidential race and not talk about that because it's such a dominant issue. And then the third thing that I think that President Biden will talk about is the importance of protecting our democracy and our institutions.
That doesn't poll that well, though.
I know. And I think he's got, he certainly has enough data to make a compelling argument. And truth be told, the Biden campaign has yet to ask me my advice on what their messaging should be. But I think in 2022, we saw examples of what Dems can do to win. I mean, we won in three of those important states that are so important to both the Senate and the president this year. Nevada, Arizona, and Pennsylvania. And I think what you saw in there is you saw that economic message. You saw choice play a big role. But also, especially in Nevada and Arizona, you saw a muscular law and order message and a stronger message on immigration. And I really think Democrats, we have to be more muscular on border security, because the other issue that is almost as potent as abortion is immigration. And we can't pretend it doesn't exist. We also can't pretend that the world sees it the way we do. I mean, politics is an empirical game more than a normative game. And empirically, most of the people see immigration as a border security issue. And we need to be responsive to that.
Okay. You said you would change the messaging. How would you change the messaging? Like, what advice would you give them?
So number one, I would focus on the future. I wouldn't talk so much about the investments in infrastructure. I mean, President Biden has an incredible record of success.
What did Ron Klain say? It's a fucking bridge. Stop talking about the bridges and the infrastructure. He's kind of right. Bridges don't get people out to vote. In fact, you're just like, wait, that's a lot of construction on the roads, traffic.
And it's tempting. I certainly get the instinct when you're running as an incumbent. You want to talk about the great things that you've done. Uh-huh. But remember, like right after Churchill won World War II, he lost like months later. We act as voters the same way we act everything else, which is we're fundamentally self-interested and we're sort of selfish. And we want to know what you're going to do for us over the next 4 years.
Right.
And so your message and your vision have to be one and the same. Your message has to be like, this is what kind of America I want to lead. And I think we're going to create in the next 4 years.
Yeah. Even though Trump's message goes backwards to making America great again, it's actually going forward. It's a weird backward forward dance.
Totally agree.
But you know his vision. You know what he's going to do from day one. There's no doubt about that.
Exactly. And I think all else being equal, I think vision normally beats no vision because it gives voters something to grab onto.
Obama, change.
Exactly. And in fairness, some of the vision you can leave to people to project, but you do have to create a vision of this is what we think the world will look like, the country will look like in 4 years of another Biden administration.
I think when Biden was running against Trump last time, the vision was stability, whether they had to put it forward or not. And the best case scenario was just to stay on the sidelines and let Trump self-defeat and kill himself, right?
Well, 2020 was really a referendum on Trump. And it just turned out that the majority of people did not want Trump to be president again.
Which is what it normally is in an incumbency, right? It's a referendum on you. And it was heightened by COVID.
Exactly. And so there's a much greater burden on the incumbent to put forth that vision than the challenger. But in 2024, I think this is going to be as much a referendum on Trump as it is on Biden, because he's such a potent political energy. Love him or hate him, you can't deny the fact that there are strong views on both sides. And you can't really deny the fact that he's a divider.
No, he totally is. But it's hard to like dismiss the fact that he is beating Biden in the polls, even by the smallest amount, which shows that he still has a lot of political strength. He almost beat him in 2020.
Yes.
Like, by what, 40,000 votes he lost by? So across the battleground states, you can't deny that he's a very powerful political force. And people have really negative feelings about Biden right now, too. I mean, over the war in Gaza, there's a lot of protest voting, the uncommitteds, you know, Arab Americans, African Americans, and just general people feeling like he's too old.
Yeah. And before we were going to speak, I went back and looked at President Biden's approval ratings. He was net positive and over 50 until the Afghanistan withdrawal.
I know. That's crazy, right?
That's when it kind of went under.
And because he promised competence. He had an innate message of competence. And then it was lost. How do you win that back? I mean, you can't when like the world's on fire right now, can you?
You know, Afghanistan, I mean, I think we've moved on from that. I don't think that's really going to drive the vote in 2024. I think the vote is going to be more about these issues that the Biden wants to talk about, the economy, choice. You know, they'll try to make the democracy an issue, although I'm just a little skeptical about that. But I think, you know, immigration is obviously going to be a big issue too. And that's why I think we as Democrats need to come up with a more muscular strategy and message on immigration.
All right, let's talk about choice, because you have a lot of great stats on how this has worked in some of the battleground states. And what's your take on this? How do Democrats utilize it and make sure it activates their voters?
Yeah. So also in preparation for this discussion, I went back to the 2022 races. Because as you know, abortion was on the ballot in six states in 22. Mm. And it won 6-0. There were three pro-choice constitutional amendments, two anti-choice constitutional amendments, and one law. But all six were resolved in favor of the choice side.
Yes.
And then 2023, obviously, choice also passed in Ohio. I think you can make the argument that choice actually won the Democrats the election in Kentucky and Virginia as well. Virginia won both state houses in part because abortion that's what Dems were running on in 23. And Governor Youngkin had proposed a 15-week ban. And that drove enough opposition that Democrats won both houses. And then in Kentucky, Governor Beshear closed with a very compelling ad on choice.
Yeah, it was this young woman talking about being raped by her stepfather and needing an abortion. I think she was like 15 or 16. Terrible.
Incredibly courageous of her to do that. So abortion, I think, if you look at the last 2 years, is 9-0. But I went to the 22 races, and I looked at the House races. Dem performance in those states where abortion was on the ballot. I looked at how Democrats were expected to perform in 2022 and how they actually performed. In swing states and red states, Dems got a 4-point bounce and Republicans lost 4 points. That's an 8-point spread on abortion. That if you just look at how they were expected to perform, that's swing states and red states. And the reason I make that distinction is because in California, there wasn't that much of a difference. But I think that can be explained because
it wasn't a threat.
Exactly. Yeah. Governor Newsom is going to take away the right to choose. But in swing states and red states, where it really is a threat, that motivates voters. And so
that's interesting. Makes sense.
Abortion has coattails. You know, abortion drives performance, and it's going to, you know, carry people down ballot.
Okay. Enough coattails to have impact in Florida, though, which has really become a red state. There is a referendum abortion measure on the ballot this time.
I think the two states where the extent of the abortion coattails will be tested are Florida and Montana. It's not on the ballot yet in Montana, but it probably will be. I think they have to get it certified by July, but the attorney general tried to keep it off the ballot. The court overturned him. So it looks like it'll be on the ballot. But John Tester, he faces a very red state.
He's a senator, incumbent. He's been there for almost 2 decades, right?
Right. Yes. And he's very popular.
In a red state that Trump won it by 14 points, right? In 2020?
I think it was 17.
17 points.
Montana. Huge margin. So Tester really needs to outperform Biden by about 9 points in Montana to win. And if anyone can do it, it's him. He's very popular. I think he's more popular than Daines. Daines is also very popular, but I think
he's a Republican senator who's in leadership.
Yes. So I think in Florida and Montana, we'll test the strength of the abortion coattails. Is the Florida Senate race, you know, Florida has increasingly gone Republican since 2012. Rick Scott, the senator from Florida, has never won by huge margins.
But he's really rich. He's the richest guy in the Senate. He spent $80 million on his last race of his own money. Crazy. I mean, I just think this means they're going to have to spend money in Florida that they didn't want to spend. Don't you think?
Yes, I think that's probably right.
Republicans will have
be more of a race than they want. But Florida was the only state of the battleground states. Well, Florida's not really battleground anymore, but to get redder between 2016 and 2020.
But I still think Rick Scott will win. I think he'll just have to spend money. The Republicans will have to spend money that they don't want to spend there. They'd rather put in Ohio or Montana or Pennsylvania or Arizona, another one. Do we think that it's Senator Gallego? It's the Democrats. Have they just won that one because of this abortion ban? I learned this from a clip of the Kelly Clarkson show. Hillary Clinton said that the governor at the time of Arizona in 1864, when they created this abortion ban, he had like two wives. One was 13 and one was 15.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. This is the guy who thought up that insane 1864 anti-abortion law, no exceptions. And I think consent then was 13.
Wow.
Make America great again. But that's even too toxic for Trump. Like, he doesn't want anything to do with that. But you own it now. States' rights.
You know, when you come out and you say that Roe versus Wade was overturned because of me, then you have to live with the consequences. You know, my feeling politically, to use the term that my friends in investments use, is let the markets clear. The pro-life community has said for years, this is what they want. This is what they want. This is what they want. Well, now they get it. But it turns out that this is not what America wants. America does not want this. In fact, there is no issue that's going to motivate people on the Democratic side more than choice. I mean, choice fundamentally, like, if you think about most of the issues that you and I, you know, probably think about and talk about on a daily basis, they're all a little bit abstract. And for a lot of cases, they're somebody else's problem, but we care about them as somebody else's problem. But when it comes to choice, for women, that directly impacts them. And it is an existential issue for many women. And it's a make or break issue for many women.
Yeah, I think most can even just imagine if they are past the years of childbearing, their daughters being in a situation where, you know, there's complications with the birth. What are they going to do? You know, you need an emergency abortion, or there's so many different reasons that people would be terrified of this. And then if you're in a heartbeat state, then you're screwed. So do you move? I don't know.
It's such a tragedy that's a choice that women have to make, that they have to move or go out of state. But in 2022, 23% of people said that abortion was their number one issue, the second only to the economy. But 76% of them voted Democrat. There's almost nothing other than like party identification that is a better predictor of Democratic performance than that issue.
Wow. Interesting. I'd never heard that before. So you think it saves the day for Democrats? It's bigger than crime, inflation, migration, all of the topics that Republicans have held on to and been much better at communicating on, and frankly have owned those issues for much longer.
Yeah, the border is going to be an issue, and it's going to be an issue everywhere. I don't think it rises to quite the same degree of choice, but the border will be an issue. Crime, you know, the interesting thing about crime is that homicides are low.
Right, they're down like 20% or something like that,
So there will be abortion referenda on the ballots in Nevada, Montana, and Arizona. Critical Senate races.
Exactly.
And Florida, as you mentioned. But I think in those three states, it will be really powerful. And in Arizona and Nevada, which we expect to be very close, if abortion gives the same bump to the Democrats in those states that it did to House Dems in 2022, then Dems win Arizona and Nevada. And as you and I have also talked about, with the fact that there's people no longer split their tickets, if Dems win Nevada and Arizona Senate races, Biden's going to win those states.
Okay, so explain the whole idea that there's no more split ticket voting. Like, just explain that to our listeners. You sent me a graph on this. So this is what you're telling your clients. Just kind of, if you don't mind, just map it out in the clearest way about this new phenomenon.
In the 1980s, one third of voters would split their tickets. And that means they would vote for one party for president and another party for an office like Senate or House. They wouldn't vote straight ticket. They wouldn't vote by team. They'd vote by individual. By 2016, it was one in 10 voters who split their tickets. So people by 2016 had vastly gotten into this team mentality where you vote for the red team or the blue team.
It makes sense because the country became more polarized and divided at that time with the onset of Donald Trump.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. We've seen, and there are a million indicators of this, is more polarized than ever. But in 2020, only about 5% of House districts went for a different party than the presidential. That was down from like 20% just a couple cycles before. In 2016 and 2020, the last two presidential races, there were 69 Senate races. 68 went the exact same way as the presidential. The only exception was Susan Collins, the Republican senator from Maine.
Who's basically an independent, but is a Republican. And it's Maine, where you can kind of get to know everybody in the state. Because like, how many people live there? 500,000? I'm kidding. There's probably more than that, but do you know what I mean?
But you're right. She is uniquely positioned to pull that off. But it is just increasingly difficult. And I'll give you actually one other stat that I just realized today that I thought was fascinating is in 2004, so 20 years ago, South Dakota and North Dakota had six people in Congress, two senators and each a House member. All six were Democrats in 2004. South Dakota and North Dakota have not voted for a Dem for president since 1964.
Wow.
So in 2004, they were comfortable voting Republican for presidential, but still Democratic for Congress. That doesn't really happen anymore. Now people vote by team. And even in 2022, where there wasn't presidential candidates on the ballot, there weren't presidential candidates on the ballot, there was still only one state that went a different way than the presidential, which was Wisconsin.
And that's kind of a state that tends to do that, right? Like Wisconsin flips back and forth all the time.
Yeah, exactly. The I'm about to max out on my stats, but there are five states now that have split delegations in the Senate. And that's the lowest it's ever been since we started directly electing senators in 1913. But both Maine and Wisconsin are in that five.
Okay. So who do you think is going to end up taking back the Senate, the Republicans? I mean, it's they're in a better position too, right? It's theirs to lose.
I want more than anything that for the Dems to hold on to the Senate. And I think that West Virginia is obviously, that's going to go Republican. So that brings Dems down to 50. So they would need to run the table and win the White House to hold on to the Senate. Ohio and Montana are going to be tough because, as we talked about, with the death of split ticket voting, they're also, it's extremely rare for Senate candidates to outpoll the presidential candidate by more than 5 points.
And like, I think Trump won Ohio by 11 points, right?
Yeah, Trump, exactly. Trump won Ohio by 8 and won Montana by 17.
Oh, so okay. 8-17.
But you're right, like big margins. And so if anyone can do it, I think it's Sherrod Brown and John Tester, the two Democratic senators from Ohio and Montana.
Sherrod is very popular. He was governor of Ohio. He's great, got name ID.
Right. Very, very popular. Exactly. Sherrod Brown has been a fixture of Ohio politics forever. And John Tester just sort of exudes Montana.
He looks like a farmer. Tim Sheehy, he was a recruit for the Republicans. He was impressive.
He was a recruit, right. I think he's relatively new to the state. He doesn't have the same roots that John Tester has. I don't know if he'll be able to be conversant in the way of life of an average Montana the way John Tester would be. And interestingly, Republicans have out-of-staters running in a lot of their competitive Senate races.
Like McCormick in Pennsylvania?
To whom I should give a long overdue congratulations for UConn winning the national tournament because he's from Connecticut.
You are snarky.
I'm sure he's psyched and I'm happy for him.
He grew up in Pittsburgh. He lives in Connecticut now because that's where hedge fund billionaires live, okay?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Let's be honest. More than half of the people in the House and Senate live in McLean, Virginia right now, right? Or Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Well, that's a little bit of a different issue because when you run for Congress, you know, some people have to move their families to D.C. Some people choose not to. But McCormick, the reality is he's been living in Connecticut for a long time. He only bought a place in Pittsburgh 3 months before he launched his 22 campaign.
Well, Dr. Oz lived in Jersey. I don't even think he moved.
And Dr. Oz did not get elected to the Senate. And I think Casey is going to win that race.
Well, people are very ambivalent about Casey. I've heard that he has like no real appeal. People don't even really know a lot about him, Bob Casey. But he's been senator there for how many decades now?
He's been senator for a long time. But his approval rating as of November was plus 16 points, which is high. I mean, not many senators who are plus 16 approval rating lose.
It's just going to be hard. I think that's going to be one of those states where, like you said, split ticket voting is probably not going to happen. And Trump lost by like half a point or 1.5 points in Pennsylvania. Could go either way. But Biden's basically in Scranton every other day. They're really working it.
You know, the Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin is, those states will obviously be critical to President Biden. But for political junkies like me, it's just interesting because of the six swing presidential states, five have close Senate elections. So you had this question over, is Casey going to help Biden more in Pennsylvania? Or will Biden help Casey more?
You think there could be some up ballot action?
I actually think in Pennsylvania, I think Senator Casey will help bring Biden over the line.
We haven't really talked a lot about Arizona, but how are you feeling right now?
So first of all, I don't know a single Republican who doesn't have the last name Lake who's excited about Carrie Lake being in this race. The Arizona Supreme Court decision over abortion, you can't understate the significance of that. In Arizona, two-thirds of independents support choice. One-third of Republicans support choice. So the constitutional amendment in Arizona is going to pass by big margins. And Carrie Lake is kind of doing a Trump where trying to walk back some of her position on abortion, some of her messaging on abortion.
She really can't help herself, though. I don't think she's been good at it.
I completely agree.
Gallego is not the strongest candidate out there, though. He's got some weird shit in his past, too.
Yeah, I think that none of that stuff is really going to matter. I think what's going to drive the vote in Arizona is you're going to have abortion and the presidential race driving the vote.
The border will be big, though, too, in Arizona.
Definitely.
Is that a flip a coin state, or you really feel comfortable? I saw some of the, like, I think it was Amy Cook. She put leans Democrat now. She moved Arizona to lean Democrat rather than toss up.
I think I agree with that. I think Lake is a very weak candidate. You know, she's not who Republicans wanted to recruit. I think Gallego is actually a great candidate. Mm-hmm. And Arizona Democrats have won 5 of the last 6 statewide races. It's still an R+2 state, but Democrats won 5 of the last 6 races. Obviously, Biden won in 2020. But with this abortion constitutional amendment as a referendum on the ballot, it just gives such a huge boost to Gallego that I just don't see how Lake overcomes that.
Yeah, so it just drives out more voters, more activist types. Interesting. But you wouldn't put it in the same category as split ticket voting, because it's not like you vote down the line on an abortion measure. It's kind of separate. You could vote Republican, but also in favor of abortion rights.
You definitely could. And so in 2022, abortion was actually on the ballot in Montana again. But in 2022, it was an anti-abortion ballot initiative. In 24, it's a pro-choice initiative. But the 24 anti-abortion initiative lost, but the 2 House Republicans won re-election. So obviously, people split their tickets there. But the Republicans in Montana did 8 points worse in performance than they were expected to.
Wow.
It shows that abortion really does have coattails. It's not dispositive. It's not going to win some of the race, but it'll give you a bump.
Interesting. Thanks so much for coming on the show. This was fascinating. And I'm impressed by all of your stats.
It's been great. It really, I was so flattered that you asked, and it really was so much fun. So thank you very much.
Yeah, and this is great. I feel like all of our listeners have gotten all of the inside scoop. This is the kind of information that a lot of corporations pay a lot of money to get into, this kind of intel. So thank you for sharing it with the Somebody's Gotta Win audience. That was another episode of Somebody's Gotta Win. I'm your host, Tara Palmieri. I want to thank my producers, Christopher Sutton and Connor Nevins. If you like this show, please share it with your friends, subscribe and rate it. If you like my reporting, please go to puck.news/Tara Palmieri and sign up for my newsletter, The Best and the Brightest. You can use the discount code TARA20. I'll be back on Tuesday.